of the big pharma industry, they're pushed onto the market, and they will push it for as long as they can benefit. And then when there's enough problems, enough deaths that they can no longer avoid it, they'll pull it off the market and then bring it back under another name. You know, so it's a big game.
Yeah.
So you're right about that. And I actually believe the same thing is true with vaccinations. Mm-hmm. I suspect, and I am doing research, I haven't come up with the absolute evidence, that this strange, deadly flu that they're having in South Korea is connected to vaccinations. Mm-hmm. And now it's a vaccination program that originated in the Middle East, and they're calling it a, what are they calling it? It's a transplanted problem. Mm-hmm. But I suspect that this is a problem that is caused by vaccinations, because vaccinations, while the science of vaccination may be true, the chemical compounds and the bacteria and the formulation of what goes into modern day vaccines are often toxic, and they inflict vaccines of such magnitude and quantity on people that it completely overloads the immune system. So a newborn child could conceivably have, 20, 30 vaccines before they reach the age of two.
Yeah.
Some 400, 500 by the time they go to school.
Yeah.
So this is an enormous load on the immune system, even if there was healthy science behind it. But the fact that the vaccines are not based on healthy science, but they're based on experimentation, you can end up with these kinds of diseases taking hold. So there's a lot to think about as we go forward, but we're actually out of time for today.
Okay.
Because it's time to make space for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. And I'm going to play another piece of music, which is a real favorite of mine. It's actually from the Robert Knight collection.
Oh.
And it is called, let me see if I can find it, Starman by David Bowie.
Okay.
So I'm going to play Starman because I do believe that there are star beings. I don't believe, I know. And they are very close by. But they're not here to save us. They're here to help us should we choose to save ourselves. So let me play this as we move to our next program. Thank you for joining me today, Paulette.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yes.
Good
Take
night.
Good care. Good night.
Let me see.
I want to make sure I have the right song. It is, let's see, Starman is number 8.
Didn't know what time it was, the lights were low, oh, oh. I leaned back on my radio, oh, oh. Some cat was laying down some rock and roll, that is so he said. Then the loud sounds, it seemed to fade, came back like a slow voice on a wave of fate. That was no DJ, that was Hazy Cosmic Jive. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he blew our minds. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He tells us not to blow it, 'cause he knows it's all worthwhile. He told me so you hurt him too. Oh, oh. Switch on the TV, we may pick him up on channel 2. Look out your window, I can see his light. If we can sparkle, he may land tonight. Don't tell your papa, or you'll get us locked up in Paris. There's a sign.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, two movie reviews and remembrance of another Pacifica person lost this week besides our mother, Phil Austin.
Sandy Dawn with a review of the Wolf Pack for Hour of the Wolf. As a society, we say we love children, but we can't resist locking them away. We say it's for their own good, their own protection, and since we are their guardians, what happens to them is our responsibility. But some caregivers have a harder time letting go than others. The Wolf Pack is a documentary by Crystal Moselle about what happens when a father refuses to let go, even an inch. The six Angulo brothers grew up on the Lower East Side of New York City under the watchful eye of their Peruvian father, Oscar. Mom Suzanne is from the American Midwest and virtually never left their apartment. Barred from interacting with neighbors, they disappeared into the world of movies, watching them endlessly and then reenacting scenes with elaborate handmade props and costumes. They became experts on the worlds of Quentin Tarantino and Christopher Nolan while remaining near innocence about the real world, which they can only glimpse from the window of their high-rise public housing apartment. When we meet the Angulos, they're a boisterous group of near-grown boys who are lean as jackals, with long hair and ready smiles. They're all extremely well-spoken. Mom has homeschooled them and clearly knew what she was doing. We see them race up and down the hallways in dark suits and ties, recalling lines from Reservoir Dogs from memory. Notes one, the reenactments make me feel like I'm living, and later adds, if I didn't have movies, there wouldn't be much point. It's hard to know how to feel about what happened to the Angulos in their self-made warren. Moselle's narration freestyle makes no judgments. We're given home video footage of a loving, engaged household filled with creativity and laughter and family dinners. But there are hints of darkness, allusions to physical punishment for rules violation. Oscar, we're told, had the only set of keys to the apartment. His belief was that the world was too dangerous, and his children, there is a seventh child, a girl who has mental difficulties, who is largely not seen, needed to grow up safe from it. My father overdid it, says one boy. He was too worried, too concerned. Yet however much tentative smiling goes on, we are watching the late stages of child abuse. Raising children so cut off from the world that they are crippled by what they do not know and have not experienced is a form of cruelty. Oscar is unrepentant, though Suzanne has a greater grasp of what isolation has done to all of them. And we're given a sense that she was under Oscar's thumb, too. At one point, she calls her mother for the first time in decades and breaks the news that she has seven kids. All of which makes the joys of the films tainted by the knowledge that it didn't have to be this way. Watching the brothers go to their first theatrical screening and spend a day in an apple orchard is wondrous. We're treated to seeing the beauty of the world Oscar so feared through their eyes, and it is a special experience. Yet Wolfpack never goes deep into its amazing story. Despite all of her access, Moselle avoids digging at the larger issues. There's no summary of how the boys are doing today at the end, either. As a cautionary, fantastic tale, Wolfpack is an amazing journey, particularly the final scenes where the boys make their first original short film together. As a documentary, though, it feels half done and unexplored. By the time it ends, it still feels as if much about what makes these boys and their parents unique remains locked away in that cluttered high-rise apartment. This has been a review of The Wolf Pack. This is Randy Dawn for Hour of the Wolf.
In Person's movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I won't tease this out any. The new animated film Inside Out marks Pixar's welcome return to form. It's funny, it's moving, it's endlessly visually inventive, and it leaves you with things to think about and possibly to grow on. And I'm not too old to still be growing, I admit that. After a string of ill-advised sequels and an attempt to put their own unique spin on the Disney princess film, leave the princesses to the folk who built the castle, guys, you're better than Frozen, Pixar returns to their core principles, which have a lot of basis in human neuroses, actually, but it works for them, so why fight it? And what's interesting is how closely director Pete Docter and co-director Ronaldo Del Carmen flirt with disaster. For those who have been living under a rock for the past 3 months, Inside Out goes inside the cranium of an 11-year-old girl, Riley, voiced by Caitlin Diaz, during a particularly traumatic period of her life as her family relocates from Minnesota to San Francisco. Turns out each of us has a control room inside our heads, commandeered by the emotions joy, anger, disgust, fear, and sadness, here voiced for Riley by Amy Poehler, Lewis Black, Mindy Kaling, Bill Hader, and Phyllis Smith, respectively. The actual focus of the film is the tension between joy and sadness. Joy considers herself the prime guardian of Riley's well-being, but sadness feels an inexplicable compulsion to become more closely involved in the girl's life, that urge represented in the film by her being drawn to the glowing bubbles that contain Riley's memories. A struggle between joy and sadness to possess these bubbles results in the two being accidentally sucked up by a vacuum tube and dispatched into the cavernous archives of Riley's long-term memory, forced to find a way back to the control room while leaving anger, disgust, and fear to cope with the emotional challenges of a child on the cusp of adolescence. Any of us who can remember that time in our lives will recognize the outcome. It's not good. There is a lot about this setup that I'm leaving out here, and that's what's interesting. Dr. and Del Carmen have endeavored to recreate the entirety of the human psyche on the verge of maturity in tangible, entertaining form, and it leads to a riot of metaphors, memories contained in glowing globes, special core memories protected by a sleek podium, key personality traits presented as floating theme park-like islands, the subconscious presented as an ominous forest contained within barred doors, and on and on. There's so much here that the directors wish to present with metaphorical accuracy while also meeting their mandate for a fun film that borders on self-parody. And it says a lot for the director's skills that the film is as coherent as it is, and that, more shockingly, everything comes together in a potent and moving finale. Doctor essentially had the same problem with his previous film, Up, which also ranged a bit hysterically over too wide a conceptual range, but managed an emotional payoff that made the chaos worthwhile. Inside Out is a bit of a mess, but it deploys that mess to get to a dramatic destination that, for a present-day family film, is astonishingly honest and well-earned. Plus, Lewis Black plays anger. Lewis Black had to play anger, and every second with the character is golden. Above and beyond that, Inside Out shows that the soul of Pixar is still alive and still vital. There are more sequels coming from the studio and another film, The Good Dinosaur, that's being released later this year that's still an unknown quantity. But for now, in the little control room in my head, joy is in command, and that's perfectly fine. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, so check out what you missed by going to mightymoviepodcast.com.
Los Angeles. He walks again by night. Out of the fog, into the smog. Relentlessly. Ruthlessly.
I wonder where Ruth is.
Doggedly. Torby's weekly meeting with the unknown. At 4th and Drucker, he turns left. At Drucker and 4th, he turns right. He crosses MacArthur Park and walks into a great sandstone building.
Oh, my nose!
Groping for the door, he steps inside. Climbs the 13 steps to his office. He walks in. He's ready for mystery. He's ready for excitement. He's ready for anything. He's...
Dick Danger, third eye.
I want to order a pizza to go and no anchovies.
No anchovies? You've got the wrong man. I spell my name Danger.
What?
The makers of fantastic cigarettes, long in the leaf and short in the can, bring you another true story from the tattered casebook of Nick Danger, Third Eye. Let's join him now in the adventure we call Cut Him Off at the Past.
Let's get down to business. Beautiful stems of yours, baby. Here's the case I call number 666. It all began innocently enough on Tuesday. I was sitting in my office on that drizzly afternoon, listening to the monotonous staccato of rain on my desktop and reading my name on the glass of the car's door. Red Mount to Smooth. And Sir Curtis scrolling on the floor.
Good afternoon, Mr. Danger. I'm Rocky Rococo.
Thanks, Half-Punch. You just saved me a lot of investigative work.
Maybe yes, maybe no. Do you know what this is?
I had to think for a minute. What cool game was he playing? That's a brown paper bag.
That's correct. Now, look inside, Mr. Danger. What do you see? Very good. Now I think you're ready for this.
Well, that's nothing but a two-bit ring from a cracker back, Joss.
I'll sell it to you for $5,000.
Huh. What kind of a chump do you take me for?
First class.
A tarnished piece of tin is worthless.
Worthless? Not to Melanie Haber. You may remember her as Audrey Farber. Susan Underhill? How about Betty Jo Bialoski?
We interrupt this broadcast of Nick Danger because, as far as I can tell, we're only broadcasting one channel. And this comes from the glorious 60s. At a time when stereo separation was very much a thing going on, so that Rocky Rococo was only in one channel and Nick Danger in the other. And here in the control room, I only heard Rocky. So I went into another room where there was a radio, and I still only heard Rocky. So I thought, uh-oh. Okay, we're getting virtually a mono mix here. Playing this off the computer. Ah, I know what to do. I know what to do. I actually brought the CD with me. We'll listen to that, theoretically. Pardon me. Theoretically, the CD player here will play two channels. Oh, am I lucky that I didn't rely only on that transfer. Okay, let's see. We'll give this a try.
Los Angeles. He walks again by night. Out of the fog, into the smog. Relentlessly. Ruthlessly.
I wonder where Ruth is.
Doggedly. Toward his weekly meeting with the unknown. At 4th and Drucker, he turns left. At Drucker and 4th, he turns right. He crosses MacArthur Park and walks into a great sandstone building.
Oh, my nose!
Groping for the door, he steps inside. Climbs the 13 steps to his office. He walks in. He's ready for mystery. He's ready for excitement. He's ready for anything. He's...
Yeah. Nick Danger, Third Eye.
I want to order a pizza to go and no anchovies.
No anchovies? You've got the wrong man. I spell my name, Danger.
Yeah. What?
The makers of fantastic cigarettes, long in the leaf and short in the can, bring you another true story from the tattered casebook of Nick Danger, Third Eye. Let's join him now in the adventure we call...
Cut him off at the past!
Let's get down to business. Uncross those beautiful stems of yours, baby.
Yeah, why?
Here's the case I call number 666. It all began innocently enough on Tuesday. I was sitting in my office on that drizzly afternoon, listening to the monotonous staccato of rain on my desktop and reading my name on the glass of my office door. Regnad Kisn. My secretary lay snoring on the floor, her long, beautiful gams pinioned under the couch. I didn't hear him enter, but my nostrils flared at the smell of his perfume. Pyramid patchouli. Yeah, there was only one joker in L.A. sensitive enough to wear that scent, and I had to find out who he was.
Good afternoon, Mr. Danger. I'm Rocky Rococo.
Thanks, Half-Pint.
You just saved me a lot of investigative work.
Maybe yes, maybe no. Do you know what this is?
I had to think for a minute.
Well, I believe
what
that
cool game was he playing?
That's a brown paper bag.
That's correct. Now, look inside, Mr. Danger. What do you see?
That's easy. That's a pickle.
Very good. Now, I think you're ready for this.
Why, that's nothing but a two-bit ring from a crackerback jocks.
I'll sell it to you for $5,000.
What kind of a chump do you take me for?
First class.
That tarnished piece of tin is worthless.
Worthless? Not to Melanie Haber.
Melanie Haber?
You may remember her as Audrey Farber.
Audrey Farber?
Susan Underhill?
Susan Underhill?
How about Betty Jo Bielowski?
Betty Jo Bielowski. I hadn't heard that name since college. Everyone knew her as Nancy. Then it all came rushing back to me like the hot kiss at the end of a wet fist. It was pig night at the Om Mani Padme Sigma house. We had escaped from the crowd and stood trembling under the dwarf maple.
Nikki, I don't know what to say. This is the most beautiful ring I've ever seen.
Yeah, Nancy. It's really neat. It cost me $5,000.
No. Nikki, how can I ever repay you?
Well, gee whiz, Nancy. How about 500 down and a 36-month contract?
What?
Or you could marry me.
That's impossible, Nick. I can't marry you. I can't even tell you why. Maybe someday.
All right, Nancy. Yeah. I understand. Sign here.
Oh, Nick. I'll never forgive you.
And I'll never forget you neither, Nancy. And that's why I called you today, Nancy. I mean, Mrs. Haber. Something reminded me of that time so long ago under the dwarf maples.
I don't know what prompted you to get in touch with me, but you called just in the nick of time.
You haven't lost your delicate sense of humor, have you, Nancy?
What? Nick, I can't talk to you now. You have to get out here right away. My husband, it's the same old place in Santa Barbara, Nicky. Oh, hurry, Nicky, I need you.
Nancy! I slipped the ring into my nose and the receiver into my pocket and headed to the door quickly. But I'd forgotten the little man with the evil grin.
Just a second, Danger. What about my pickle?
You're lucky you still have your brown paper bag, small change.
Danger, you haven't seen the last of me.
No, but the first of you turns my stomach.
You'll be hearing from me again, Danger.
I headed down the hall in the opposite direction toward the fire escape. I hadn't a moment to lose.
Hey, Danger. Where's the fire?
In your eyes, Lieutenant Bradshaw.
Don't get wise with me, Peeper. You're lucky we didn't burn you on the Anselmo pederasty case.
Look, you caught him, didn't you?
Yeah, but the punk got away, no thanks to you.
Well, what brings your flat feet sniffing around here now, copper?
Just a friendly word of advice, Danger.
Yeah, what?
Don't go sticking your big nose into police business.
Sure, Lieutenant. Is that all?
No. Don't talk with your mouth full.
Okay, Bradshaw.
And don't fidget while I talk to you.
Sure,
and stop
Lieutenant.
Tracking mud across my nice,
okay.
Clean...
Okay. When I hit the street, the rain had already turned L.A. into a mud river. It was a short swim down Alvarado to my convertible. I had to get to Santa Barbara in a big hurry. As I whipped onto Mulholland Drive, the lights were just twinkling on across the San Fernandino Valley. So I could barely make them out through the driving rain. Then a hard right down Big Tujunga Canyon. My tires squealed as I hit several feet. A right, a left, a left, another right, a left to the body, a right, and into a gas station. Hey, Pop!
All right, hold your horses, I'm coming.
Hey, yeah.
Where am I?
You can't get there from here.
But I'm looking for the same old place.
Oh, you must mean the old same place, sonny. It's right out back. Here's the key. Yeah.
4 hours later, I parked my car in the carriage house and walked up the gray gravel driveway between a line of dwarf maples toward the pillared entrance of the same mansion. It had been snowing in Santa Barbara ever since the top of the page, and I had to shake the cornstarch off my mucklucks as I lifted the heavy obsidian door knocker. Hey, in there! Open up! Your door knocker fell off!
What's all this brouhaha?
Brouhaha?
Wait a minute. Don't you want this door knocker?
I already have one.
But this is yours.
You see? So... I told you. We used to have another one, but he vanished mysteriously. All right, come in out of the cornstarch and dry your mucklucks by the fire. Let me introduce myself. I am Nick Danger.
No, let me introduce myself. I am Nick Danger.
If you're so smart, why don't you pick up your cues faster?
Are those my cues?
Yes, and they must be dry by now. Why don't you pull them up out of the cellophane before they scorch? All right, sir. May I take your hat and coat?
Yes.
I assume you've come to see my mistress, Mr. Danger.
I don't care about your private life or what his name is. I've come to see Nancy... Mrs. Haber.
Mrs. Haber?
Audrey Farber.
Audrey Farber?
How about Betty Jo Bialowski?
Oh, you mean Nancy. Well, she's in the aviary stunting trees. I shall return with her straight away. You may wait here in the sitting room, or you can sit here in the waiting room.
There was something fishy about the butler. I think he was a Pisces, probably working for scale. I felt a thin shiver run up my spine as I sat down on the cold marble floor. What was it about this place? The atmosphere was as phony as the Tudor balustrade that leered at me from the top of the staircase. And there she stood, radiant. All those curves showing through that flimsy burnous.
Well, yeah, but if you get an external...
It was Nancy running down the stairs. All the familiar sounds and smells of pig night came rushing back like a good snort of scotch. Then it struck me. 20 years later, and she still knocked me out.
Nick, darling, am I? Nicky, Nick. Nick, wake up. Are you all right?
Yes.
Oh, then stop slapping me.
Nancy. What's the bird's eye lowdown on this caper? Whatever that means.
Nick, we can't talk here. We can't talk here.
What does it mean we can't talk here? Oh, you're right, we can. What's the way to do?
Follow me. This way.
Lovely. This is much better. We're at the chapel now. It's soundproofed, so no one can hear us.
What did you say?
I said no one can...
What?
Never mind. It's follow me.
What?
Here, take my hand. This way. This is much better.
Yeah. Pretty fancy layout you've got here, Nancy. What's this, your boudoir?
Oh, no, these are the kennels.
Putting on a dog, eh? Well, say, where are all the doggies?
They've mysteriously disappeared.
Oh, yeah?
What? Yes, I just told you. Along with the servants. They were very attached to one another.
Where?
At the wrist and ankles.
Wait a minute. You said all the servants had disappeared.
Did I?
What about your butler?
No. You mean Catherwood?
Yes, madam.
Catherwood! Oh, you startled me.
I'm sorry, madam.
What are you doing there on all fours?
I'm looking for my script. Why don't you just go on without me?
Listen, Nancy... I smell a rat.
So do I. I think he's got my script.
Yes, Catherwood, you look for it, all right?
All right, madam.
Nick, quickly, through this sacred panel.
All right.
Over here.
This is the portrait gallery.
The real?
This is the portrait.
There's an echo in here. This is the portrait gallery, Nick. It's the safest room in the mansion. Mm. No one can find us here.
All right, Nancy. Get your hands off me. What's the scoop?
Chocolate, butterscotch, or Rocky Rococo Road.
That reminded me. How had she gotten herself involved with that slimy weasel Rococo? And how do I make my voice do this?
Oh, Nick. It all began 20 years ago with the mysterious disappearance of my husband.
You mean you were already married when I sold you that ring?
No wonder she hadn't been able to meet the payments.
What?
So that was your secret. Oh, what a sap I've been.
Oh, yes. But that night, the strangest thing happened.
That usually goes along with being just married.
My husband, Johnny, Nick, I want to tell you the horrible truth, the whole truth, all of it. The man behind everything.
Gee, madam.
Let me handle this, Nancy. Far out, Catherwood. Just roll a couple of bombers and leave them on the side table.
Yes, madam. Pardon me, madam. I seem to have crashed. It's been such a long exposition, you know. I'm so tired.
Catherwood.
Yes, sir.
Catherwood, can't you see you're upsetting Nancy? Leave us alone.
Well, how much would you like, sir? 500? 1,000?
I am Scray Osterbay.
Oh, of course, sir. Hello, Kookachook, sir.
Isn't it?
Yes. I'm so tired. I haven't slept.
All right, Nancy, go on with your story. Start with your dreadful secret.
Oh, Nick, I can't. I can't. I'm so confused.
Well, why don't you just hold your thumb next to your line? See, like this. Huh? This way I don't get confused and I never lose my place.
I feel faint. The whole world is spinning.
Why, that's lucky for us, Nancy. If it were flat, all the Chinese would fall off.
On the board?
Why, she's no fun. She fell right over. Wait a minute. Didn't I say that line on the other side of the record? Where am I? I'd better check.
Who is now?
It's okay. They're speaking Chinese. Poor Nancy. She's fainted. I'll just wrap her skirt around her head like this to keep her warm. Now I'll press her body close to mine to keep me warm.
There, spread eagled on the floor. I beat the eagle off and gave her a quick mouth-to-mouth resuscitation jab. And then it struck me.
What a sap she had!
Good girl, Nancy. That ought to hold him for a while.
Oh, poor Nicky. He's bleeding. Yes, I'll tear this strip off my petticoat. There. You tie him up with this. I'll go through his pockets.
All right. Careful. Don't wake him up.
Oh, that contract must be on him somewhere.
Audrey.
Your fuels.
What?
Haven't you found the contract yet? Your time is almost up.
Rococo, you slimy blackmailer. How did you get in here? You don't have a key?
No, only half a key.
What?
I had to split it with a sound effects man.
Thanks, Rocky.
Where is the contract, you absent-minded old fool?
Wait a minute. Here it is. I found it. It was taped to his leg.
Give me that. I've got it at last.
All right. Now, maybe you'll leave us in peace, Rococo. Give me the negative.
Of course. Here it is.
At last. Now we're out of your evil clutches.
Dan, wait a minute. Look at this negative. It isn't us. It's an interesting approach, but it isn't us.
She's right. What are you trying to pull on me, Rococo?
Oh, my goodness. I must have sent the wrong negative to the police. I must have left yours in the car. I'll go get it.
A second, Rococo. You're not going nowhere until you've explained what you've done with that filthy piece of blackmail.
Are you threatening me? Why, you stupid toad! I ought to beat your brain out!
No! Put down that pickle!
You'll never get away with this, Rococo!
Oh, yeah? Didn't you ever see Casablanca?
The thick veil of pain lifted enough for me to eyeball the situation. Rococo, that sleazy weasel, how did he get in here? And what was he doing with that pickle in one hand and my contract in the other? I had no choice. Nancy and the old butler were frozen with terror. I struggled quietly to my feet and flung myself headfirst at Rococo's stomach.
Thank you. You saved our life.
This ain't no time for ticker tape parades, baby. Get me out of these ropes and into a good belt of scotch.
Let me hold that contract for you, Mr. Danger.
I'll keep that contract, Catherwood. But you can take this pickle off my hands.
Oh, no, I think you better hold on to that, Nick.
Good thinking, sweetheart. Lieutenant Bradshaw will need all the evidence he can get.
Yes. And you should stick around, too, Danger. You can help him put all the pieces together, you know.
Right.
No, a left.
I felt like I was being kicked in the head by the whole chorus line at Minsky's. So Nancy was in on this caper. I felt myself going under. The biggest long shot, Louis at Hialeah, wouldn't put a fin on my fate now. This time, something told me I was out for lunch. I even began to hear things.
Hold it right where you are.
I'm Lieutenant Bradshaw with a piece of advice for you. Now, here in the studio, it's all knuckles and know-how. But when that red light goes off, I'm just plain Harry Ames, citizen and weekend father. Now, take a tip from a cop who does. Radio work can be just as dirty and exciting as hunting down public enemy number one. So when I get home, my old lady knows what I need and how. A warm, heaping bowl full of looseners, castor oil flakes with real glycerin vibrofoam. It doesn't just wash your mouth out. It cleans the whole system right on down the line. So come on, you little rookies. Tell your mom to get on it and do it every day. Just remember what the guys down at the precinct house sing.
Oh, it ain't no use if you ain't got the boost. The boost you get from looseners. Looseners.
The all-weather breakfast.
Now our bites won't prevent.
And now we return you to Act 3 of Nick Danger, Third Eye.
When the crazy escalator ride ended, I fought my way back up to the land of the living. I came to slumped over in the front seat of my own car, lying in a pool of cheap rot gut. I had a head full of ideas that were driving me insane and a mouthful of cotton candy.
You want some more cotton candy, Danger? It might sober you up.
Oh, my head. Bradshaw, baby.
Yeah.
I never thought I'd be happy to see your ugly mug.
Save the wisecracks for the warden, Danger. I got you this time, and I got you good.
What are you talking about?
Get out of that car.
Hey, come on.
If you can stand up and keep your hands high, I got you covered.
Hey, what's this all about, Bradshaw? You know I never carry a rod.
Yeah, but
hey.
It's murder what some people can do with a car, and I got witnesses to prove it.
There's a man. Keep me away from him.
Take it easy, little lady.
I don't know why you're doing this, Nancy, but it doesn't change my feelings about you.
Oh, Nick, you're such a tool. He did it.
All right, take it easy, little lady. All right, now let's get these facts straight. Take this down, Henderson. Okay, Professor, how did it happen?
Well, Sergeant...
Lieutenant.
Yes, Mrs. Farber and I were sitting right here in the living room engaged in a friendly round of spin the pickle, weren't we, dear? Yes, with our good friend, Mr. Rococo. Yes, and then suddenly the door flew open and this drunken madman right here drove in, honking wildly and headed straight for us.
He's lying, Bradshaw!
Can it, Danger?
Yes, at the last possible moment, he stopped on a dime.
I see.
Unfortunately, the dime was in Mr. Rococo's pocket.
I'm gonna break your neck, Catherwood!
All right. Hold it, Danger! I've heard enough. We'll get the rest of the story down at the station house from you.
I've been waiting for this for years.
Wise up, Bradshaw.
Week in and week out, Danger, playing second fiddle while you got all the girls. I'm tired of being Mr. Nice Guy. See, there's gonna be some changes made. Next week, this show is going to be called...
Sergeant Bradshaw,
Lieutenant.
District Attorney!
I'm going to have my own theme music, and it's all going to take place in Washington, D.C. No plots, just girls and guys doing nice, simple things up against Nazis and fifth columnists, and no Jewish writers, either.
I saw my chance, and I took
my name in the papers.
Bradshaw
my
would never listen to my story now. Colonel it had more Lindbergh, holes in it than
Charles
Albert Hall.
Foster King.
My only way out was... Jack like this!
Catherwood, stop it. I've got Bradshaw's rod pressed against Nancy's tongue. Now you spill the beans or I'll blow her brain out.
I think you're bluffing, Flatfoot. No, you weren't bluffing.
All right, talk.
It all began 20 years ago. I was a freshman in college then, although you wouldn't hardly believe it to look at me now. I had just completed work on my science project, and I invited Nancy down to reveal the secret to her.
Yeah.
Well, this is it, Nancy. How do you like it?
So this is where you've been every night since we got married.
Sure is.
Oh, Nicky, I thought you were...
Danny, but don't say it, Nancy. I know it's been hard, but I wanted to give you the swellest honeymoon a girl had ever had. We're going to Greece.
And swim the English Channel?
No. To ancient Greece, where burning Sappho loved and sang and stroked the wine-dark sea in the temple by the moonlight wa-da-do-da.
What?
Don't you see, Nancy? I've built the perfect time machine.
Oh, it sounds dangerous.
Yes, that's why I'm going to try it out first. Now, when I get into this grandfather clock, you hit me over the head with this bottle of champagne right here.
Oh.
Set the dial for 1,000 and put in 3 dimes.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be gone for 1,000 years.
1,000? Oh, that's longer than anyone's ever been gone before.
But to you it will seem only like a minute. Very well, my love. Now, forward into the past!
Yeah, I hope he gets back
you know, all this dry ice melts.
What's the point?
Who's there?
Mrs. Haber?
Who's that?
I'm Rocky Rococo. You may have seen me loitering around the drugstore drinking chocolate malted Vulcans and giving away free high school.
What are you doing here? What do you want?
I'm here for a friend, Mrs. Haber. If you sign a contract, you're supposed to keep up the payments.
Oh, you must be a friend of Nick's.
Yes.
Well, he couldn't want his money already. He only gave me the ring last night. I'm wearing it, see?
Yes, that's a very pretty hand you have there.
Ancient Greece. Look at this grape.
Oh, who are you, old man? What have you done with my husband?
What do you mean, Nancy? I am your husband. Well, who's that ugly dwarf with his hand in your mouth, Nancy?
Rocky Rococo at your cervix.
All right, Catherwood. I've heard just enough.
What?
I'm
telling this story, young man. What are you doing in my flashback?
Flashback? What? Flashback. All right, all of you. You stay right where you are. Put your thumbs on your place in your script while I figure this out.
So that was her horrible secret. Poor Nancy, married to a man 1,000 years old. Now I understood why the servants had disappeared. It was Catherwood who killed Rococo to protect his wife, my Betty Jo.
Who is he talking to? How does he make his voice do that?
All right, Bradshaw, there's your confession. I hope you got it all down. Bradshaw? Bradshaw. Oh, that's right. He's not in this flashback. I'll skip ahead a bit. No, I can't skip ahead. All right, everybody. Into the time machine.
No. You don't understand how radio works. Now, this is my flashback. All I have to do to return us to the present is fade my voice out like this and cue the organist. And you see, here we are.
Oh, my goodness.
What's happening? Am I seeing double? There's two of everybody except me.
Pandemonium was breaking out all around me.
Wait a minute.
Who are you?
I was here first. You imposter. Take that.
Terrible.
You keep away from him, you young hussy.
Who are you calling a hussy, you old bag?
Well, how dare you talk to me like that?
I can talk to me any way I like.
Oh, nerve, I'm not you. You're me 20 years ago.
What? You have a lot of nerve saying I'm going to look like that in 20 years?
Oh, yeah? There ain't room enough in this dress for both of us. Get your knife.
Well, this is a bit of fun, isn't it?
Yes, it certainly is, Dad. Glad to have someone my own age to talk to after all these years.
Why don't we sing something?
Well, I've forgotten the key.
Oh, that's all right. I've got a lid out in the car.
David?
Half-caste woman, living a life apart. Where did your story begin?
Stop it. Cheating, you fools. Can't you see someone has been crashed here under this car? Oh, my God, it's me. I don't look at all well. I'm dead. I've been killed. Oh, this hasn't happened to me since M.
I did a quick 20-20 on the whole scene. I thought that I was the only one going insane. But now we were all in this together.
I knew what I had to do.
I didn't like it, but that was the same before. All right, everybody, take off your...
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt this scheduled transmission to bring you an announcement of national importance from the White House in Washington, D.C. Ladies and gentlemen...
Clear, go.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, this morning at 6:25 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, combined elements of the Imperial Japanese Navy and our forces ruthlessly attacked our naval base at Pearl Harbor in the Hawaiian Islands. I have conferred this morning with the Congress and the Chiefs of Staff in emergency session. We have reached our rendezvous with destiny. It is our unanimous and irrevocable decision that the United States of America unconditionally surrender. And now my wife and I would like to return with you for the thrilling conclusion of Private Nick Danger, Third Eye.
Because I've solved another one for you.
Danger, I'll never know how you do it. I was sure I had the goods on you this time.
Well, Bradshaw, it's like in the army, you know. The great prince issues commands, founds states, vests families with fiefs. Inferior people should not be employed.
Nick, I can't knock success. But you still put me through too many changes.
The makers of Loosener's Castor Oil Flakes and Fantastic Cigarettes. Loosener's for the smile of beauty, Fantastic's for the smile of success. And brought you the transcribed adventures of Nick Danger, Third Eye. Tune in again next week, same time, same station, when Nick Danger meets the Arab.
All right, let's do the little...
Rolling.
Yeah, this one. Okay, Phil, you put on the ball pit. We'll go to the other side. Something she said.
How much time? How much time have we got?
How much time we got?
Why don't you say that? Okay, well, that's that. Yeah. How much time? Oh, look at this.
Okay, hey, Cyrus.
We're on now.
Cyrus.
Do we have to...
I'm going
over to the other side of the record.
Yeah. I'm going to come in from the...
How much? How long does it take to get over the other side?
Okay, wait a minute.
Just a minute or something. We haven't got...
Come on,
have you got your ball, babe?
Oh, right.
Come on. Look, let's just do it. Has anybody got my script?
Hey, Cyrus, here you go.
Scene 3, take 600.
Somewhere in the black mining hills of Dakota, there lived a young boy named Rocky Raccoon. And one day his woman ran off with another guy, hit young Rocky in the eye. Rocky didn't like that, he said, I'm gonna get that boy. So one day he walked into town, booked himself a room in the local saloon. Rocky Raccoon checked into his room, Gideon's Bible. Rocky had come equipped with a gun to shoot off the legs of his rival. His rival, it seems, had broken his dreams by stealing the girl of his fancy. And she called herself Lil, but everyone knew her as Nancy. Now she and her man, who called himself Dan, were in the next room at the hoedown. A Rocky burst in, and grinning a grin, he said, he drew fast and shot, and Rocky collapsed in the corner. Proceeded to lie on the table. He said, Rocky, you missed your match. And Rocky said, Doc, it's only a scratch. And I'll be better, Doc, as soon as I am able. And now Rocky Raccoon, he fell back in his room, only to find Gideon's Bible. And he left it, no doubt, to help with good Rocky's revival. Oh, yeah, yeah.
as Lister pointed out, a great song, and it certainly is. It certainly is. Well, you know, so I had my mic open. Thank you, the two people. One emailed me and another texted me. Well, I was trying to figure out, or after I'd figured out the problem, Max called me in order to tell me more or less what's going on. And basically comes down to that the computer that we all use here to play stuff is in mono. Lister likes that because Lister plays a lot of music and... that music has stereo separation. It's music you mostly produced, right? Yes, yes. It's music he's mostly produced. So he would like you to hear both channels. And wouldn't we all? But I was really, really lucky. I had done a what they call a rip. I'd taken Nick off of an album and made a copy of it, and I was playing that through the computer. Fortunately, I actually brought the album with me, very luckily, very fortuitously is a good word. And so we were able to get the stereo by putting it through the CD player. Okay, folks. We have a reading for you. Lev Rosen, who was on my show 2 weeks ago. Oh, you didn't hear it? Oh, that's because the transmitter and internet feed were down. And he read a short story that was really cool and really great. But he read from his new novel, Depth, at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings about a month ago. And before he got up and read, I said, Lev A.C. Rosen is the author of Depth and the forthcoming middle grade novel, Woundabout. His first novel, All Men of Genius, was a finalist for the James Tiptree Jr. Award and was selected as one of Amazon's best SF/F books, that's science fiction fantasy, books for September 2011, and appeared on several other best of science fiction lists that year. He is from Lower Manhattan and now lives in even lower Manhattan, right at the edge of the water, with his husband and a very small cat. So, we take you now back to, just about a month ago. Set your Wayback Machine for about a month. And at least this doesn't need to be in stereo, so I hope you enjoy it. And then, time permitting, some more Firesign Theater. Oh yeah, this time I'll turn off my mic.
Thank you, Jim. And thank you for hosting this event. So, yeah, I'm going to read the first chapter and then a little bit of the second chapter, which will unfortunately necessitate me doing what I describe as a faint Scandinavian accent. So I might just not try that at all. So here we go. She had the shot. It was lined up. She just needed to wait for the fog to clear, and it was going to clear in a moment. She could read the swirls of it, how it breathed and parted. New York City fog was lazy, like cigarette smoke. A small vibration in her right ear. She clenched her jaw and waited. The fog didn't clear. Her ear vibrated again. She sighed and whispered, phone ID. A hollow projection beamed out from her earpiece, displaying a small screen in the corner of her vision. She glanced at it, and as she did, the fog swirled open for less than a heartbeat, then closed like a lover's kiss. She ground her teeth. Caroline Kahn read the display. Answer, she told the phone. I'm working, Simone said softly. She was on a rooftop, four stories above her targets, and they were in a boat below her, but she was careful. Voices could carry out here. I sent you a present, Caroline said, her low voice smug. You're going to want to thank me. You just made me miss my shot, Simone said, so let's call it even. No, Caroline responded, without a hint of guilt. It's not my fault you don't turn off your phone while stalking. Stalking is what people do for fun, Simone said. Following a cheating husband to get photos of him with his special friend is business. Don't try to convince me it isn't fun for you, too. Simone rolled her eyes and squatted down, letting the camera hang low in her arm. She leaned against the railing and closing the roof. "Why am I going to owe you?" Simone asked. "I sent some business your way, attractive business." "The business or the client?" "The client is attractive, the business is lucrative and easy. Is this going to be a long conversation?" "Maybe," Caroline said after a moment, "but only because I'll be laughing a lot." "Can I call you later, then?" "Just meet me at Undertow when you've got the money shot. Call if you still don't have it by 11. "Will do," Simone said, rising back up and trying to point her camera in what she thought was the right direction. "Later." Simone touched the earpiece to turn it off. The fog rolled out for a moment, and the boat below her became perfectly clear. It was a floating restaurant, permanently moored, with a large open deck made of wood covered in with tables and chairs. Fancy, too. White linens, low lighting, and waiter in tuxes. The couple she was looking for was sitting in a corner, far from the entry bridge. He, Simone knew, was Henry Saint-Michel, whose wife had hired Simone to tail him. She was a blonde, and most definitely not Henry's wife. Most cheating spouses cheated with blondes. She snapped a photo, her camera silently capturing Henry and the blonde. The fog rolled back in, blocking her view. Simone looked at the photo she had just taken. They were sitting across a round table from each other. The blonde's back was to Simone, but Henry was fairly clear in the shot. He didn't have a romantic expression. He had a nervous one. Simone zoomed on the camera's display, taking a closer look at Henry. He was in his 50s, pudgy, balding, goatee, glasses. In the photo, his brow was furrowed into a stack of skittish creases. Simone aimed her camera again and waited for the fog to clear. When it did, she held down the release, taking about a dozen more shots before the fog closed around her. The images in her camera did not become any more romantic. They showed Henry taking out an envelope from his jacket and passing it across the table to the blonde. She slipped it into her purse without looking inside. Then the waiter came over and took their order. Simone rolled over her neck. Miss Saint-Michel had only suspected an affair when she hired Simone. Her exact request was to find out what her husband was up to. From the look of it, it wasn't an affair, but it was still suspicious. Even if the envelope was just cash, no one used cash anymore unless they had to, and passing it across the table in an unmarked envelope didn't exactly make it seem above board. Simone squatted down and leaned on the rail again. She needed a shot of the blonde's face, but she couldn't get it from this angle. She pressed a button, and the camera shrank down to the size of a business card, which she slipped into her trench coat sleeve. Then she stood and walked to the stairs at the other end of the roof, glancing out briefly before heading down. Sorry. She was on the roof of a 24-story building, so the ocean lay four stories down, churning just below the 21st floor. The fog was thick, but she could hear the waves lapping at the other buildings around her and the worn wooden bridges that connected them to one another and to the permanently moored boats that made up New York City. New York, city of bridges and boats. The green light of algae generators pulsed through the fog here and there, giving the view an eerie glow, and through it the silhouette of the skyline bursting from the sea. It wasn't the iconic skyline of the past, just the top, with wide plains of ocean between crumbling towers and large boats floating low on the horizon like a steel archipelago. Waves left streaks of yellowed foam like a sea chart against the buildings and boats. Everything smelled and tasted of salt. Simone walked down to the 21st floor and stepped onto a bridge via a large window that had been converted into a door. Most of the city's bridges clung to the buildings, wrapped around their exterior walls, and branching off into streets that connected nearby buildings or boats. Sometimes the bridges were nice, well-kept, wide enough for many people. Sometimes they were like the bridge Simone was walking on now, creaking wood planks hovering over a hungrily lapping ocean. The banisters were splintery, so Simone didn't touch them. Waves splashed at her ankles, but she'd grown up here. She was used to it. New York, though technically still part of the United States, had long begun to consider itself its own country, hundreds of miles from the Chicago coastline and the conservative religious mainland. The Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial had been airlifted to Salt Lake City, but no one tried moving New York. All the other drowned cities, like D.C. and Boston, were graveyards now, spires and flat tops of buildings tilting out unevenly from under the water like old headstones. Not New York. Though some older buildings had been worn away by the waves, Others, retrofitted and laminated in that technological wonder glass steel, stayed where they were as the ocean rose, closing off the bottom floors as they filled with water. There were newer buildings, too, designed to withstand the water, and decommissioned boats clever entrepreneurs had bought and moored around the city. There were a million New Yorkers left, and they were stubborn. They built the bridges themselves, and everyone bought personal algae generators and desalination filters for their apartments, stringing them out the windows into the sea. They reassembled their city. They stayed. Simone walked the bridges that took her to the boat restaurant's entrance, a well-preserved metal ramp that connected the bridge to the deck of the ship. The bridge here was wider and had a few lamps rising up and over it, like old street lamps, but with tubes that went down into the ocean to small algae generators that pulled the bright green stuff up and converted it to electricity. The railings were high enough and solid metal, so the waves seldom splashed on the bridge in calm weather. A taxi boat stand bobbed just down the bridge. It was a nice area, well kept. Strands of violin music came from the boat. Simone stood on the bridge, lit a cigarette, and waited. It was an early dinner, only 6:30, but the sky was darkening and the fog was at its thickest. Maybe they chose the time because of the fog, Simone thought. The cigarette tasted dry and acidic in her mouth. It wasn't her preferred brand. If she had them, she smoked the old-fashioned ones that killed slowly, but those were hard to find, so she had settled for the non-cancerous ones that cleared out your sinuses, left your teeth whiter, and were just as addictive as real nicotine. Simone settled in to wait. Waiting was a large part of being a private detective. She smoked two cigarettes and wondered what the envelope Henry had handed the blonde contained. He wasn't a big deal, as far as she knew. Not in politics, just an export-import guy. His wife had the money. She was from the European Union, the part that was still dry thanks to the dikes, not the part that was all gondolas and canals. They had met when she was traveling and decided to settle in New York because she loved the ocean, not that there wasn't a lot of ocean everywhere else. He ran the business with a partner, mostly bringing stuff out of mainland America as it became illegal, banned books, birth control, scandalous art, and sold it in Canada or the EU. Simone couldn't think of anything he could have come across that would require shady dealings outside the office. Maybe looted art from before the flood, but that stuff was sold pretty openly in the city. It could be smuggling, but with the amount of money his wife seemed to have, he didn't need to. They came down the ramp a little after 7. Not a long dinner. Not the sort of dinner where a couple gazed into one another's eyes over creme brulee and sighed. They weren't holding hands as they came down the ramp either. Simone flicked her cigarette into the ocean and pretended to study the menu posted next to the restaurant's ramp. Henry and the blonde walked down the bridge and stopped at the taxi boat stand. Henry nodded an awkward-looking goodbye and got into a waiting yellow boat. The blonde waved goodbye after him. Simone watched the blonde walk further down the bridge and wondered who to follow. She still hadn't gotten a good shot of the blonde, and her instincts told her Henry was on his way home, so she walked down the bridge, trailing the blonde, her shoulders hunched, head down slightly. The blonde turned onto one of the main bridges, huge things reinforced with suspension lines holding them up, always crowded. Sometimes you might even see an old gas-powered car in one of them. Simone followed the blonde, picking out details of her through the fog. She was petite, wearing a blue jacket and a knee-length skirt. Her hair hung pinned straight to just above her shoulders, as if afraid to make contact, and it swayed when she walked. When she turned, it covered her profile. Simone couldn't get a good look at her face. The blonde didn't look like a New Yorker. Her boots were tall and waterproof, but they had heels. Her dress was short enough to move in, but tight, and if she were a major player in the city, Simone would have known her already. Simone guessed they were headed for a hotel, probably the Four Seasons. It was down this street and off another. The blonde looked like she could afford it. She pulled her camera out of her sleeve, turning it on without the zoom so it stayed small. The Four Seasons was in front of them, the white-painted steps up to its marble terrace built right onto the bridge. The doors had originally been the wide glass doors from a suite to a balcony, and they hadn't changed much, except now the glass was tinted for privacy. They shone black in the fog, a doorman standing in front of them like a dark mast. He nodded at the blonde, who nodded back and then turned, as if aware of someone following her. Simone tilted her head down to hide her face, but raised the camera and took as many photos as she could. The blonde's eyes scanned the horizon, but didn't seem to find Simone. She turned back around and went inside. Simone eyed the doorman, wondering if he would tell him who the blonde was, but he had the look of an old dog about him, the kind who would stay loyal even if bribed, if only out of sheer laziness. Simone turned away. It was enough for one night. She'd call Miss Saint-Michel and find out if she knew the blonde. Simone looked at the photo she had just taken. She was a blonde who could refreeze the ice caps, one of those pretty but cold, ageless faces that could be 21 or 40. Long bangs, a stylish haircut if Simone could judge by advertisements. She rubbed the back of her neck where it started to ache and put the camera back in her sleeve. Then she took off down the street, walking to the bar to find out what sort of attractive client or job Caroline had found for her. Now I'm going to skip ahead just a little. We're going to skip the scene with Caroline and get back to the blonde. Simone lived on the sixth floor above sea level of an old 30-story building, its brick walls mirror smooth from the waves. The rent was cheap because there was a chance it could fall into the sea at any moment, but Simone liked that. It was in an area of town her dad used to call Alphabet City, but which most people now called Carta Rojo for the large tanker in the center of the neighborhood. It was a relatively peaceful place with plenty of bars below the various decks. People were quiet, or at least not too loud. It wasn't like the touristy area to the west or the expensive places uptown. It was just the city, cool, wet, uncaring. She had large picture windows that she'd had to reinforce against the ocean storms, but which gave her a nice view of a flat expanse of water and the buildings just beyond it. On bright days, when the sun was at the right angle, she could see a building maybe 10 or so feet below the water, like a reflection of what the city once was. The water was too shallow to dock a large boat over the building, but too deep to build anything on top. Small taxi boats and private yachts sailed over the empty water at all hours. Sometimes it was a lake, sometimes it was an intersection. Simone's apartment had been huge once, with high ceilings and decorative wooded beams that gave it a slightly rustic feel. She had turned the front part into her offices, an old-fashioned front door with Simone Pierce Investigations carefully lettered across the frosted glass window. Inside was a waiting room with chairs and a desk for a receptionist, if she could ever afford one, and behind that, a table and sofa. From there, through another more tightly locked door, was a hallway leading to her office, the kitchen, and a bathroom. No one was waiting for her, so she locked the front door for the night, shut the light, and went into her office. She lived in her office, and it showed. What money she made was spent there. She had a relatively up-to-date touch desk, the kind that looked like a long curve of black glass that curled up into a wave on one side, ending in a flat screen. She placed her palm on the desk to turn it on, the black glass becoming a series of images. She shrugged off her coat and hat, put them on the coat rack by the door, and sat down at the desk. She slid the small inbox symbol up to the flat screen and tapped it once so it expanded. She had six new messages, but nothing pressing. If she were like Caroline, she'd have an expensive wrist piece connected to her phone and her home office through a high security cloud, and she could check all her messages from one place. But when she was out, she was usually working and preferred as few distractions as possible. Her phone and office were cloud connected, so she could always have messages that came through her touch desk dictated to her by her phone. She just didn't want a screen on her wrist that affected her aim. She lifted her left leg to take her gun out of its ankle holster and put it on the desk. The images under the gun twitched, realizing something was covering them, and reorganized themselves to another part of the desktop where they could be seen clearly. Simone turned her earpiece back on while walking to the kitchen. It was only 9:30. She called Miss Saint-Michel's personal line. "Hello?" Miss Saint-Michel answered. She had an accent Simone couldn't place, some sort of European, maybe Scandinavian. "Miss Saint-Michel, it's Simone Pierce." "Ah, yes, Miss Pierce." She hesitated on the other end of the line. Simone switched on the light in the kitchen and turned on the coffee pot. "Do you have something to tell me?" Miss Saint-Michel's voice wavered ever so slightly. If Simone hadn't known better, she might have thought it was part of her accent. "Can I ask you first when your husband came home tonight?" "Perhaps 7:30, maybe a little later." "Why do you ask?" "Just checking a hunch, Miss Saint-Michel. If you're going to be the one to tell me my husband is cheating on me, you may as well call me Linnea. Being called Miss Saint-Michel and then being told Mr. Saint-Michel is unfaithful makes it all seem like we're just actors in a play. This is my life." "Linnea, then," Simone said, licking the bitterness off her lips. She hated it when clients got personal. "I took some photos tonight of your husband with another woman, but I don't think it's an affair. I would appreciate it if you would look at some photos of the woman in question and tell me if you recognize her. May I send them to you?" "No." Henry is home, and I don't want him to walk in on me and find me staring at photos of him that should not exist. I will come to you. Tell him I need some air. Simone looked out the windows. The only light was coming from the city's buildings and algae generators, but she could make out some heavy clouds on the horizon. Linnea, it's going to storm soon. Maybe we should wait until tomorrow? I could never sleep. I will come over now. That is okay, yes? Yes, I just don't want you to drown on your way. Don't worry about that, Linnea said, her voice a sigh. I will be there soon. Sure thing. Linnea hung up, and Simone shook her head as she poured herself a cup of coffee and took it with her to the waiting room. She unlocked the door again and turned the light back on. Simone went back to her desk to read her messages, sometimes glancing out the window at the approaching storm. Lightning flashed in the distance, and she could hear the wind on the windows. Walking around New York, even without the high waves and strong winds of a storm, was dangerous enough. The city was permanently slippery and poorly maintained, and try as they might, shoe companies couldn't make your soles completely slip-proof. Rip currents had taken up residence around all the buildings, a complex map of tides and undertow. Struggling against them would drown you, but relaxing and letting them carry you would end with you miles out to sea, far from the city, if your head wasn't bashed into some debris on the way. But during a storm, being outside went from merely deadly to suicidal. One wave could throw you against the side of a building, and you'd fall off whatever narrow bridge you were on and into the water, unconscious. The next day, the recycling boats would find your body while dragging the water and deliver it to the recycling center, where they'd look for your IRID or some other identification. If you were lucky and your IRID hadn't floated off your body or been taken along with your wallet by a particularly ambitious recycling boat worker, then notifications to your family would be made. But if you had no identification, like most drowned people, and your fingertips, lips, and eyelids were too damaged from water and hungry fish to get a fingerprint or a facial scan, they took your photo, pinned it on their bulletin board, and posted it online. Your body would be kept at the recycling center, and if no one claimed you in 2 weeks, whatever nutrients could be harvested from your corpse were sucked out and the rest of you burned, the ashes poured back into the ocean. Simone tried to check the website regularly, just to make sure no one she knew was on it. On average, there were between a dozen and 20 new faces every week. Simone's messages weren't anything interesting, aside from an amusing bit of gossip from Danny about one of New York's elite coming in for a psychic reading to ask if his mistress was cheating on him. About half an hour and two cups of coffee later, there was a gentle rap at the door, and Simone walked out to the waiting room to open it. Linnea stood in the hall. She was an attractive woman, somewhere in her 50s, the kind who aged gracefully, though whether that was natural or not, Simone couldn't tell. Her being well-dressed wasn't a surprise, but still the richness of her clothes took Simone back. She wore a fur-collared bronze trench coat that went down to her ankles, and under that, a perfectly tailored golden sheath of a dress that ended just below her knees. That meant she'd had a ride over. Dresses, anything that tangled your legs if you slipped, were idiotic in the city. That's why women were never fined for wearing pants, even though it was technically a federal offense. Linnea took off her coat and handed it to Simone, but left on her hat, a small bronze oval perched on her chocolate hair, from which hung a long veil down to the shoulders, and it was all made of dry skin. Even the veil, Simone was willing to bet, had thin layers of the stuff over the holes in the netting. It felt like nothing, stretched like spider webs, and breathed like air, but when water hit the fabric, it broke into 1,000 droplets, never penetrating, just hanging there like diamonds until they dripped off or evaporated. It was the same stuff they used to waterproof electronics these days. Expensive. Even Caroline didn't have a complete wardrobe of it. Simone only had one coat made with the stuff. She went back to her office and carefully hung Linnea's clothes. Linnea, Simone said, motioning for her to take a seat on the other side of the desk. Linnea did so and crossed her legs. She was wearing high heels, ridiculous to even own in the city unless you never had to walk anywhere. I'm a bit nervous, Miss Pierce, Linnea said, clasping her hands in her lap. I've been wondering what you meant when you said you did not think it was an affair. Simone nodded. She got up again and went to the coat rack to take out her camera out of her sleeve, then turned it on and put it on her desk. The desk automatically started downloading the photos she had taken, displaying them as small images on its surface. Simone tapped them once so they grew, then slid them around so they were facing Linnea. You see, I've done plenty of cheating spouse cases. There's nothing romantic here. It looks more like a business deal. That's why I wanted to ask if you knew the woman. Simone tapped a shot of the blonde's face, enlarging the photo even more. Have you ever seen her before? Linnea shook her head. No, but they are at a restaurant together. Isn't that like a date? I don't think so, Simone said. They didn't touch, and they didn't go back to a hotel together or anything like that. Henry went right home after dinner. Did you hear their conversation? No, but I can plant a bug next time if you'd like. Simone scratched her chin. Linnea nodded slowly. So what does this mean? I don't know. I was hoping it was just a business associate, and then I would tail him again tomorrow. But if you don't know her, I want you to follow him again anyway, Linnea said resolutely. He is not himself lately. A wife knows. Something is amiss. Perhaps if it doesn't seem like an affair, perhaps it is something else. Perhaps the envelope had a payment for a girl for another time. The girl could be a dock mistress who keeps a boat of sirens. Simone shrugged. If you want me to, I'll keep tailing him. Please, I want to know what's going on with her, Linnea said with some distaste, tapping at the blonde's photo, accidentally causing it to enlarge so that it took up the entire desk, her forehead and chin cut off by the edges. I can do that, Simone said. Thank you, Linnea said, standing up. That is all, I assume? Yes, Simone said. I should mention, Linnea, that the longer I follow your husband, the more expensive money is of no concern, Linnea said with a wave as she took her coat off the rack and slipped it on. She turned to look at Simone. As I said, a wife knows when something is amiss, she said, her voice low, the dim lights of a boat outside the window running over her face. Raindrops began to hit the window with light thudding noises. Will you be all right to get home? Simone asked. Yes, I have a yacht and a driver, she said. Simone nodded, safest way to travel. I'll let you know as soon as I find out anything else, Simone said. And I will call you if I discover anything on my own, Linnea said. She looked Simone square in the eyes for a moment. The rain became heavier all at once, moving from light drops to a heavy drumming, thick rivers of water streaming down the windows. Thunder clapped. Linnea adjusted her veil and smiled at Simone, then nodded. Good night, she said. She left the office and the waiting room, the clicking of her heels blending into the sound of the rain. Simone looked at her desk again. The giant face of the blonde stared back at her. Simone lay her palm flat on the desk to turn it off. Then she turned off all the lights and went to her bedroom. Her bedroom was in the corner of the building, with windows on two sides, looking out over New York and the heavy storm that had descended on it. It was almost completely black outside, except when lightning struck, for brief moments illuminating the city skyline and the surging waves devouring it. In one flash, Simone saw a yacht motoring swiftly away, like a white arrow in the darkness pointing at the horizon. When the waves surged so high that the wind could carry the spray up to her window, blurring it with flecks of salt and algae, Simone closed the drapes, stripped, and got into bed. A large mirror hung opposite her bed, but when Simone tapped a screen on her nightstand, it turned into a video feed. She absentmindedly flipped through the shows, news programs, and old movies they sometimes ran. She sighed, nothing interested her. She turned the video feed off, and the screen went back to a mirror. She shut off the light and rolled over on her pillow, falling asleep to the sound of waves and rain and the occasional shudder of thunder through her drapes. Thank you.
And you've been listening to Lev Rosen reading, Lev A.C. Rosen, actually, reading from his novel Depth on Better Newsstands, if there were newsstands, at Better Booksellers right now. A really good book, and I thought it fit with Nick Danger very nicely in terms of noir, New York noir. So, anyhow, we do have one more thing to bring you, hopefully with my mic off, and it is not just written by Phil Austin, who was so iconic for Nick Danger, but it is nonetheless another signature piece of the Fire Sign.
Well, I think it's about time. The way the corn's been growing for the last two or three generations.
Look at that herd of buffalo. They're ready.
Everything's living the Great Spirit's way, in harmony.
He'll be here soon.
The true white brother's coming home. Remember what the Great Spirit said? If we did what we were supposed to do and lived according to the plan, White Brother would finish his work in the East and come back to us. It'll be nice to have the family together again.
Buenos dias, amigo.
Hello, you must be the true White Brother.
Sure, you must be the Indians.
Yes.
Welcome home. Welcome to New Spain. This is your new father, Father Corona.
Down on your knees now. Do you recognize what I'm holding over your heads, lads?
It's a cross, the symbol of the quartering of the universe into active and passive principles.
God have mercy on their heathen souls.
What the father means is, what is the cross made of? Gold. Have you got any?
No.
What about the seven cities of gold? Phoenix, Tucson, Las Vegas?
This is gold.
What's that?
Corn.
Hey, corn! Now we can make tortillas!
We've been waiting for this for hundreds of years.
So this is all you got?
Yes, but aren't you the true white brother who's supposed to come and live with us in peace?
Sure. Therefore, I claim this rich verdant of pasture land in the name of the Empire of Spain.
Hey, Capitano, the rain, she's a stop to fall. And the corn, she's all dead.
Shut up, Vespucci. I claim this stinking desert in the name of the Empire of Spain forever. Let's go.
God bless Vespucci land.
Oh, by the way, Domini, you're all Catholics now. God bless you.
Come on, Father. Nobody in their right mind would live in this stinking desert.
Come on, Cisco.
Boy, I'm tired of pushing west. How long ago we leave Goshen?
About 2 hours ago. Ain't we ever gonna stop?
Quiet down, my boys. Wagon boss.
My fellow settlers.
Hold it down.
We stand here at the edge of civilization on the banks of the Mississippi River, looking west at our destiny. What may appear to the faint-hearted as a limitless expanse of God-forsaken wilderness
is
in reality a golden opportunity for humble, God-fearing people like ourselves and our families and our children and the generations a-coming to carve a new life out of the American Indian.
Welcome, White Brother.
Engines! Pull the wagons up into a circle!
Why do you always do that?
We get better reception that way. Do you mind if I put this antenna up on yonder peak?
That's our sacred mountain.
This is our sacred antenna. It's shaped like a cross, made out of aluminum. Got any aluminum?
We've still got some corn left.
Hey, corn! Now we can make whiskey!
We've been waiting hundreds of years for this
invented Tom Collins.
Here, Engine, you want some fire water?
No. We were warned by our elders not to drink anything that would make us weak or silly.
Put it in their well.
That's not a well. It's the eye of the Holy Serpent Mound on which you're standing.
It's a butte.
No, it's a mound.
And right purty, too. Can you move it?
But why?
Railroad's coming through. Right now.
Hey, what are we stopping for?
We in Goshen yet?
Can't go no further. This here's engine territory.
Well, then, it's treaty time.
My fellow Redskins, speaking for the Great White Father in Washington and all the American people, let me say we respect you savages for your native ability to instantly adapt and survive in whatever godforsaken wilderness we move you to. Out there. Sign here.
They did it!
Yeah!
No reason to complain. It's not so bad out there. We still have our people and our ceremonies and the sun, moon, and stars and the sand and the black stuff coming out of the ground.
Black stuff coming out of the ground?
Civilization! Ah!
Hey,
nice out here in the desert. No rain, no crops, no white brother.
All out for Fort Stinkin' Desert. Last Indian reservation for 2,000 miles. You got 15 minutes, folks. Get them while you can.
Get the senator back in the bus.
God damn you, pesky redskins. Which way's Goshen?
Howdy there, colorful replica of America's past. When is the exciting in its primitive splendor snake dance going to take place?
It's usually in August, but with all our children off in Indian school, there's no one left to do the ceremonies.
Hiya, Pop.
I'm home.
Hello, Soaring Eagle. It's good to have you back from school.
Oh, come on. Call me Eddie. I'm an American now.
What have they been teaching you?
Just what we need for a better life. French horn, Italian... Water polo? Yes, at the Custer Memorial Indian School. Eddie's one of our prize students. We're giving him away next week.
Oh, my white brother.
Hey, man. Don't let him bring you down, though. There's a lot of young people in this country just like myself who really know where the Indians at. And don't worry, soon we're all going to be out here on the reservation, living like Indians and dressing like Indians and doing all the simple, beautiful things that you Indians do. You got any peyote?
Hey, how much is that necklace you're wearing?
Do you know how to do the war dance?
Hold it, smile.
Isn't it amazing how they survive on this stinking
they
desert?
They got any scalps?
Hey, let me get a shot of you and your squaw.
Hey, let's see the war dance.
Let's see the dance.
Let's see the dance.
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 Dance. Dance. Dance. Dance. Dance. Dance.
Okay, okay, folks. Fun's over. Back in the bus.
Where's little Billy Joe?
He's in that run-down outhouse over there, Mama.
That's our sun altar.
Well, Indian, just goes to show you there's an obvious need to conserve our priceless national heritage. The government is turning your home into a national monument.
It behooves me upon this historic occasion to dedicate the Stinking Desert National Historical Indian Monument and Cobalt Testing Range. Civilization! Ho!
It's about time. There's been no corn growing for the last few generations. The buffalo's gone. There's no one left to live in harmony.
I wonder where we went wrong.
Let's just keep to the life plan. Remember what the Great Spirit said. Follow the peaceful way. The true white brother is bound to come.
All right, Indians, get ready.
Winning of the West, the massacre, take four.
Well, let's go.
The Firesign Theater. Nothing quite like them. They were genius. We lost Phil Austin this week. And another member of the Firesign Theater last year. But that stuff will live on forever. Sheer, sheer genius. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. I will be back next week at 1:30 in the morning. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister, which is already in progress. Oh, yes. And be good to each other.
atmosphere. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the
big
red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol. How oppression, let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. While I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the peace work. Tell me I'm wrong, though that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm no lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Born the material of the imperialist in a blazing inferno. Cause my hurt is internal. The American dream, a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies the pigs make up. Imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist, cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison? Cause I'm pissy attack with the flag. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this shit. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talking about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx. Yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn. What? Betty Raw soda. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on, just a mother. You gave me freedom of speech and the First Amendment. So why the f*** wanna scold me when I touch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so
making fun. If you should stop and raise your hand, sir.
Stop and raise your hand, sir.
I am the questionable answer.
The questionable answer.
Here's the answer.
See, I'm a slow learner.
A slow learner.
He is the Congress page turner.
Congress page turner.
Yes, sir. I'll get a turn right away.
I was a late bloomer. The Autobahn Zoomer.
Autobahn Zoomer.
Yes, I'm the hard time shifter.
Hard time shifter.
Shifter.
I am the gift card grifter.
The gift card grifter.
Grifter.
I'm at the voice box luncheon.
The voice box luncheon.
Got my guitar axe crunching.
Guitar axe crunching.
I'm the saltine
heartthrob. Saltine heartthrob.
Saltine heartthrob.
I am the greasy spoon poon job.
Greasy spoon poon job.
Greasy spoon poon job.
I am the home improvement wrecker.
Home improvement wrecker.
Wrecker.
I am the sack fact checker.
Sack fact checker.
Check it, check it out.
I'm just a sidewalk preacher.
Sidewalk preacher.
The hard knock school teacher.
The hard knock school teacher.
Teacher, teacher.
I am the lightning strike breaker.
Lightning strike breaker.
Unnecessary risk taker.
Unnecessary risk taker.
Unnecessary.
I'm just a sidewalk preacher.
Sidewalk.